Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the March 23rd, 2010 Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems in the data center. I am your host and moderator, Dave Vellante. I'm here at the Wikibon offices in Marlboro with John MacArthur. Hello, John.
Hello, Dave.
And the topic for today is infrastructure strategies, application versus infrastructure-centric approaches. And then we have a number of people on the call today that have participated in a recent Wikibon study to understand the issue of infrastructure and how organizations are planning infrastructure in 2010. And we're pleased to be joined today by Omer Pera. Omer is the former CIO of Aetna International and Joseph E. Seagram. Hello, Omer. Say hello and welcome to the Wikibon community.
Thank you, Dave, and hello to the Wikibon community.
Wikibon's David Floyer is also on the call, I believe, and David prepared much of the data that we're going to share with you today. Hi, David. Are you there?
Hi. Good morning to everybody.
Some quick housekeeping items, if we may. I want to refer you, as I said to some folks earlier, to the Wikibon homepage. So if you go to wikibon.org, in the middle of that page, just under the orange Register Now button, you'll see a section called Professional Alerts, and the first one there is entitled Background Data for the March 23rd Peer Insight. And in there, you'll see some of the data that we're going to present today. Again, I'd like to ask, if you're not speaking on the call, please mute your line. And if your phone doesn't have a mute button, you just hit star 6 to mute and star 6 to unmute if you wish to participate, which everybody is welcome and encouraged to do. This call is being recorded and will last 1 hour. If you want to tweet this call, please use the #Wikibon hashtag. So again, welcome Omer and David and others who have joined the call today. It's a pleasure to have you here. Let me just set this up. So the discussion today is around the topic of infrastructure, and specifically, should infrastructure's function reside in application stacks or hardware? And an example is recovery. So should I place recovery function in, say, Oracle or Exchange, or does it make more sense to place that function in, for example, a storage array or a SAN? And I want to tell you right off the bat, the research that we've done shows that at scale, it's more expensive to place function into application stacks, i.e. shared infrastructure at scale is cheaper because, well, it can be shared. But there are often clear benefits to placing function in application stacks, and we're going to discuss those today. And as well, for small and mid-sized customers that don't want to deal with the complexity of SAN and other infrastructure, it's often cheaper to place function into application stacks. So this is one of those it depends examples. So just by way of background, we've interviewed well over 20 practitioners in support of this research, CIOs, application heads, infrastructure professionals, and technical experts. Many of the people we interviewed are on the call today. Some want to remain anonymous, but the point is we've received excellent feedback from a number of different constituents. So what I'd like to do is start the call with Omer. And Omer, I want to read to the audience some of the comments that we received from practitioners and get your reactions. And I'd like to start with the CIO. So I'm just going to go through a few of the things that we heard from the CIOs and then ask you to comment. So the first one is, quote, infrastructure is evil. It needs to be simpler. The second one is, quote, I'm the CIO. I'm not in the hardware or software business. I'm in the business to deliver value. Speeds and feeds are nice, but what does it do for my business? There's four that I'm going to reference. The third one is, quote, we used to have one of everything where businesses made decisions independently, but that didn't work so well. Users want dial tone. And to provide that, we have to unify our business model on a standard set of IT services. And then the last one, if a vendor can really save me money, I'll listen. But I need to understand how I get from where I am today, point A, to where I'm going tomorrow, point B, without jeopardizing the business. So, Omer, I think that fairly summarizes what we heard from the CIOs. I want to start with, what do you think about that infrastructure is evil comment?
It's a necessary evil, Dave, as I think we all know. And certainly from the CIOs and the CIO perspective, the application, i.e. the business value, I believe trumps any of the infrastructure decisions. If, you know, push come to shove, what does it do for the business? As pointed out in one of our interviews in a hospital, if there's some new technology that is a life and death breakthrough, not going to worry that much if it doesn't fit the infrastructure. If it, you know, if it add significant business value, we're going to do it. You know, so application value, I would say, trumps infrastructure decisions in most cases. So there's the business value. There's three dimensions: business value, the business risk, and the business risk is how do I get from A to B? And vendors come in, and it may have some cost advantage of 5 to 10%. But if I'm going to have to divert my application developers and the functions that they provide to the business, then I may not want to do that. I may not want to take that risk of jeopardizing the current functions. And certainly last but not least is the cost factor. You know, if it, as pointed out in one of the comments, if it saves me money, great, but tell me what does it do for the business and how do I get from A to B?
So I want a follow-up question. From a sure. CIO's perspective, what do you mean by business value?
Business value is how does it affect the bottom line, the profitability of the company? Does it help me increase revenue, or does it help me reduce business costs, not necessarily infrastructure costs? And can I grow market share? Can I add to the profitability of the company?
Okay, so pretty straightforward definition in your mind.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, from a CIO's perspective, if I come in and say, all right, I get this notion of how we can consolidate everything and standardize and save you money, your point was, tell me how I get from A to B. Well, a lot of times that answer is going to be, well, I have a services organization. Is that an effective approach, or what are your thoughts on that?
It's an effective approach, and they have services, but now I have to pay for those services, and I have to add that to my cost factor. And then by doing that, the services are going to come in, and they're going to work with my infrastructure or application heads. So I'm putting up resources. I'm putting skin in the game, and I have to factor into that cost equation how much I'm going to spend with the vendor and how much I'm going to use of my critical limited resources. And if I'm using those resources to enhance my infrastructure, am I losing anything in terms of increased business application function value where those developers would have been doing something else? And if it creates a risk of the installed base, I may not want to do it.
Okay. What I want to do now is I want to read three other comments, one that we got from an application head. And a lot of times, by the way, we had CIOs, application heads, and infrastructure heads in the room at the same time, which was pretty interesting. And so I want to read a comment from application head and then two comments from some infrastructure heads, again, is by way of setup. So the application head said to us, quote, we said, what matters most to you? And he said, what matters most to me is, number one, availability. Number two, availability. Number three, performance. Number four, end user experience. And then he went back, availability, 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 and service levels. And he says, what about cost? He said, yeah, sure. Cost, that's important too. It's clearly down on the list. Infrastructure heads, not surprisingly, different perspective. Quote, a well-defined services model cuts costs and improves services to the business. It also shuts vendors up. They can't disagree with it. They can only comply if they want to sell to me. The next statement from the infrastructure head, other end of the spectrum, is we have very informal chargebacks, and the businesses pretty much do what they want. Of course, we end up paying for it. So what you see is application heads clearly have their heads in the user experience, and infrastructure heads, the dependency seems to be chargebacks, and we'll come back and talk about that. But I just want to open it up for a second to anybody else on the call. Based on what you heard from CIOs, application heads, infrastructure heads, any surprises there? Anybody want to elaborate? Stop there and give you a chance.
Hey, this is John Blackman.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing well. You know, it's interesting that from what I've heard, you know, from a CIO's perspective, I agree with you. Providing storage and the services around them is very, very difficult to articulate in true business value, because storage is generally always a cost mechanism. It rarely does it ever add revenue. The only way it really adds value to the business is by reducing the cost. I would also agree that the application people, they view the service that infrastructure provides as always being the most robust so that getting deficiencies within their code is, shall I say, alleviated by the fact that we provide a very highly scalable, highly reliable type infrastructure. And if there ever is a problem, it's either that we're not available to them or it's a lack of performance that's being given. As far as an infrastructure person, when he looks at the service model, he has defined SLAs. And those defined SLAs are, in essence, like the difference between going to a McDonald's restaurant to get food off the shelf or going to a McCormick and Schmidt's or some, you know, nice restaurant and sitting down and your food takes significantly longer to get. But the difference is that you understand when you go to those different places that what you pay for in the way is what you're getting for in that class of service. So the infrastructure person tries to provide varying classes of service to meet varying business requirements, regardless of what the application person is really looking for, which is give me the fastest and the best.
Excellent. So, John, I'm glad you joined the call today because we're going to present your model. So having you here as a practitioner to represent it is even better. So thanks for those comments. I want to come back to you a little bit later in the call. Anybody else? Any comments? If not, I'm going to move on. Okay. So let me summarize the top five findings that we saw in this out of this study. Number one is a clear desire from executives to simplify infrastructure across the board. Not surprising, but the Google effect seems to be taking hold here. And there are two broad strategies. Essentially, one, standardize on a services model along the lines of what John Blackman was just sort of alluding to. And then the second is build infrastructure services into software stacks, for example, within Microsoft and Oracle, on somewhat of a bespoke basis. The second finding, and we did a lot of technical research on this as well, that David Floyer led and some other practitioners that we invited in, Oracle, from a business resilience standpoint, is very credible, more so in our view than Microsoft. We'll talk about that a little bit just in terms of where Oracle's at in the maturity versus Microsoft. But Microsoft is definitely a force within the application development community, especially within mid to smaller size businesses. And as we all know, Microsoft is suggesting to people that they don't use, for example, SAN on Exchange 2010. Rather, they're recommending simplifying infrastructure with DAS, as is Oracle in many cases. The third finding was organizations that use chargebacks are much more receptive to an infrastructure services approach than those that don't. The fourth finding, and we touched upon this in Omer's discussion, CIOs care about risk and business value. Application heads are focused on the SLA and the end user experience, speed of deployment, business flexibility, and of course business value that's received or delivered. And the infrastructure heads care about service levels and, of course, cost. And then the last finding that came out of this, which was sort of orthogonal to all this, was that cloud adoption is definitely limited within the space that we talk to what I'll call the virtualized data center. CIOs seem to be very, very cautious amongst the 20 or so folks that we talk to about bringing legacy applications into the cloud. Having said that, when you talk to the lines of business at these organizations, they're all doing some sort of cloud, whether it's SaaS or maybe some EC2 stuff for development. And generally, we think the cloud adoption has been accelerated by the downturn for a good 12 to 18 months. So those are sort of some of the clear findings that came out of this. And then what I wanted to do was point again to that data link that we sent out. And just for those of you who don't have it, if you look at the wikibon.org homepage, under the orange register now, there's a section called Professional Alerts, and the first one there is entitled Background Data for March 23rd Peer Insight. And in there is some data that we're going to present today. And you see the first slide that you see is the fork in the road, that application-centric or array-centric. And I want to have a little discussion around this. We've got John Blackman on the call, who's a practitioner who, John, I think it's fair to say, which camp you're in, you really have innovated at previous company, a bank, and in your current organization, a storage services model that's a menu-based approach. It's a standardized approach. And then the other fork, which is the left-hand side of this fork, if you will, is the application-centric view. And I'm hoping there's some folks on the call that can talk about the pluses and minuses of that. So David Foyer in the call. Let's start with you. It's often more expensive to go, as we said, with this, especially at scale, with this application-centric approach. So why would practitioners place function, for example, recovery or storage management, into application stacks?
Well, the you mentioned before that Oracle has a fairly robust application stack with its ASM functions and with DataGuard. And the reason why people want to look at that is that database recovery, database consistency is vital for rapid recovery, for any sort of RPO or RTO environment. And in an environment where specific applications are very database heavy, where you want to put the maximum amount of functionality, then they would provide a better solution in that situation to a storage services. So if you want that bespoke, then that's the best you can get. It's expensive, very expensive, a lot of overhead, a lot of additional license fees for that, but definitely will give the highest levels of recovery.
Okay.
Microsoft is another example. There it's a different value proposition, which is that you can just have what they provide is a set of services which helps to reduce cost or make it simpler, make it easier to apply at the low level, at small. Our research showed that below 200 seats, 100 seats, 50 seats in an exchange environment, then the costs are lower because you've got lower administration costs, you've got lower storage costs. The storage isn't under that much pressure, and you can reduce costs in that way. But clearly, as you go up the stack, up the pressure on the infrastructure, then those services aren't as robust. For example, IP replication isn't as robust as the services that are available in the storage, any normal tier one storage array. That's an example. The functionality takes resources, isn't as efficient. And in general, a general purpose application stack will not have the levels of functionality that you can get in a storage services stack.
Okay.
But there's always a trade-off for these things, and there's sometimes very good reason that it should be in the application stack if that's of high value and high importance to the organization. And I think the Oracle one is probably one of the best examples of that.
Okay, so the point there is if you can justify it, then by all means. I wanted to bring Rob Pegler into the call. I heard Rob on earlier. Rob is a technologist, and I wonder, Rob, if you can share with us an architectural perspective. Rob's with Xiotech. And Rob, we have seen a storage function migrate from the host into the array for the last 15 years, and you and I have talked about this on Twitter and other venues. We're starting to see a migration back, and David gave some examples. DataGuard, ASM, Microsoft's DAGs, Database Availability Groups are another example. Can you provide a perspective from an architectural standpoint as to what's happening here, Rob?
Dave, sure, and thank you for inviting me on the call. I'll give you a brief, the way I see it in terms of architecture, especially in infrastructure. And you're absolutely right. There has been a trend. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it was actually very important for arrays to provide a recovery function, a snapshot function, things like this. And now we see those features commonly implemented over a broad scale of arrays, from the very small to the very large. However, in the last 2 or 3 years, it's been interesting that the providers of sophisticated applications like Exchange, like SQL Server, like Oracle, and there are other examples as well, BB2, for example, are migrating, no pun intended, function back into their stacks really because of two big architectural trends. Number one is the available CPU horsepower that is in servers today, multi-core, multi-socket, much more processing power than was available even just 5 years ago, and now the advent of 64-bit architecture as well has really opened the floodgate for applications to write some very sophisticated code bits and manipulate volumes and snapshots, replication sets, backups, mirrors. For example, in Exchange, you know, you can do peer-to-peer replication now. Version 10, mailbox availability, that is
the hard
drive, but it used to be.
Come on.
Hey, Rob, let me interrupt you here. Somebody is on the call, and if you wouldn't mind muting your line, we'd appreciate it. It's a little hard to hear Rob. So star 6 if you don't have a mute on your phone. Sorry, Rob, go ahead.
No, not at all. I was wondering if there was an echo back there. I guess there was. But in any event, very sophisticated function now and really built in to the application. Now, of course, your mileage may vary on the application cost. As John and others said, you know, licensing costs are always there, and you do have to take that into consideration. So that's the number one trend in architecture is much more capable servers, CPUs, and especially 64-bit architecture. Second big trend is actually down at the storage layer. There have been a lot of gains, especially over the last 3 years, in storage architecture, and we're seeing a trend now from very large monolithic arrays into a much more element-based approach to storage. Not just the modular, but actual element-based, very much like Blade Server Compute has been done over the last 5 years. So you know you have a compute blade. Now people are talking about the quote-unquote storage blade, which is better described as a storage element. And yet it fits into the middle of what traditional DAS, in other words, internal disk inside a server, which is absolutely right. It is probably better at small scale. It tends to be more expensive at large scale because of the inherent architecture of internal disk and server. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, which is large monolithic arrays in a traditional SAN architecture, be it fiber or iSCSI, which tend to have cost advantages at a very large scale. But the problem is you're also locked into a particular storage vendor, and this is what the application stacks are trying to get away from, locking you in at lower levels of the infrastructure. So the middle path is really the element-based, where it is actually locally attached to a server or a set of servers, but its storage is not necessarily shared as in a SAN. And that's really the essence of the element-based approach, and it has the cost advantages of DAS at small scale and the scaling advantage of SAN at large scale. So it's kind of the third way, as it were, and we're seeing an increasing adoption of that. Microsoft is pointing people toward a direct attach of storage, especially in Exchange 2010. They lowered the I/O requirements, even to the point where the cost issue at scale is still there as well. So that middle path, that element-based approach to storage, and as well, the element-based approach solves the performance problem, which John mentioned, that application stacks may lack performance. Well, it turns out that a good amount of the time, that performance problem is actually the storage which the application is trying to access, either read or write or a combination thereof. So actually improving the storage infrastructure and using an element-based approach can actually reduce cost and allow the organization to monetize its storage asset in terms of time. Well, if I can do 30% more transactions in unit time, how does that affect the business value, to Omer's point before? So this new trend in terms of element-based storage, which is kind of in the middle between DAS and SAN, is actually a very interesting trend.
Okay, thank you, Rob. I appreciate that perspective. There's one thing I can't let slide, which is the comment you made about locking in, which is true. You get much more flexibility at the storage layer. Of course, guys like Microsoft and Oracle want to lock you in at a slightly higher level, so we just wanted to point that out.
You have to pick your poison on some.
Right, pick your poison. Again, there's some folks that we get a lot of background noise. We'll give everybody a chance to comment, but star 6 is you don't have a mute on your phone. Otherwise, please don't interrupt as somebody's speaking. Does anybody else have any comments, just from an architectural level or from the other end of the spectrum in terms of benefits or drawbacks of an application approach? And if not, we can move on. But I just want to give everybody a chance to talk. Okay. So let's talk about the next sort of concept that I wanted to introduce here. And this comes back to John Blackman's notion of stored services. And we were going to present some data on what we found. We did some modeling on the various approaches, which we'll present in a moment. But the next concept that I want to present is this notion that it's a slide that says stored services are. And basically, it's a cube that John Blackman developed. Now, John, I've simplified the cube. There's a lot more nuance to this. And just in the interest of time, I've scaled it down a bit. But there's basically three dimensions. You've got your essential components of infrastructure in dimension one. The second is data protection levels. So from continuous data protection all the way to, you know, reliable, let's call it, and everything in between. And then the third dimension is performance tiers. So you get the very highest performance down to, you know, good enough and everything in between. And the intersection of these three dimensions is a service that you provide to the business. And you sell it as a business capability. And you price it as such. And the idea behind this approach, and certainly doesn't negate any of the architectures that Rob talked about. In fact, that's one of the beauties of it, is you can bring in, roll in and roll out architectural concepts as required, although you don't want to do that too often. You probably want to refresh your portfolio every 18 months or so. But the idea is that you have a standard set of menu-based services that allow you to reuse the infrastructure across applications, have transparent pricing on for different SLAs, and it's comprised of tested and approved technologies that essentially the infrastructure group owns. Is that right, John?
Yeah, at the highest of levels. So the model itself is designed twofold. The cube was designed mainly to be able to communicate up and down with a common language. So an engineer knows what he's supposed to be building, as well as the business can understand what they're buying. So, you know, if we go back to an earlier comment, is what value are you, what business value are you bringing me? Are you increasing revenue or are you lowering cost? The standardization definitely lowers cost. It also exposes the exact cost of doing business so that a business or even an application developer has the ability to say, well, I know that this application does not need the highest of tier of service. And so therefore I can reduce my cost and therefore maybe reduce the cost of business of actually developing an application. At the same time, the beauty of the cube also recognizes that there are services that are outside storage. I do not believe that continuous data protection, what we may want to term as an operational recovery or disaster recovery tier zero as opposed to a tier one, which has maybe a four-hour RPO. So let's just say the RPO is, say, sub-30 minutes. It makes it very difficult for a storage service to provide a continuous data protection mechanism or service at a reasonable cost. And generally, it will cost less to do it right now at the application level. One of the things that Oracle has recognized and what they're pushing with the data guard package that we've talked about, I believe that it is more economical and also much more reliable and robust than what we can do at the storage layer. So the services model itself recognizes categories of service and what it is that we can provide. They are standardized, which allows an engineer a very repeatable process to build infrastructure. And because it is repeatable, it also reduces operational costs to any line of business. I also believe that the model itself only addresses 80% of, in essence, all infrastructure projects or all application projects that would come through, mainly because if you try to address 100% of everything that you believe would come through, your turnstile that's on your menu would be so large you could not do everything effectively. So you also want to take that service model and become very effective with what you can do, and therefore the one-off. And that's, again, another thing about the application. If you drive things from an application perspective, you're going to have more one-offs, which actually increase cost. So if you can find where 80% of your applications, maybe even 90% if you're lucky, can fall into the service model, you will over time reduce your actual infrastructure cost, and therefore that translates into maybe not revenue, but it's money in the company's pocket.
Okay, so in your experience, 10 to 20% one-offs is actually probably advisable, is what you're saying, because you can't do everything through the turnstile with the services model. But what you don't want to have, in your experience, is an 80% one-offs.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, infrastructure, it's shown, if you're running in a 20 to 80%, so 20% is standardized, 80% one-off, your CIO is going to find a way to outsource you to the cloud.
And it goes without saying, but I just want to clarify. So you and your previous organization, your current organization, heavy use of chargebacks, correct?
Yes. Matter of fact, chargebacks are rather interesting. Some organizations use chargebacks more as a method to show what the actual costs are, as opposed to actually charging different lines of business, where my previous organization used chargebacks not to just show, but actually generate revenue for the IT organization. So if you put it in the definition of your cloud services, an organization with a well-defined chargeback model is an organization that actually operates as a true internal cloud to their own company.
Okay. What I'd like to do now, I want to present two other concepts from the data. Again, going back to the link that I shared with you earlier. So thank you, John, for chiming in. And then I want to come back and open it up to a discussion. So we've got some time here for discussion, but I want to share with everybody our findings. So we went out, we took a lot of this in-depth interview data that we had, and Floyer built an ROA model. ROA stands for Return on Assets. And what we found is that on average, the average life, I'm going to ask the question and then let you guys think about it and I'll tell you the answer. What's the average life of a storage array? What's the average age of an installed storage array? So think about your answer. So we went out, we did a bunch of research, we had actual field data here. The answer came back that it was 4.7 years. Okay, so a lot of the ROI models that we do, you know, Mea Culpa and others do, essentially assume a rip and replace. So what Flora set out to do is a much more sophisticated model that looked at the profile of infrastructure at, you know, one-year-old, two-year-old, three-year-old, four-year-old, five-year-old, et cetera, looking at different, you know, CapEx, the different support costs, different power and energy profiles, et cetera. So we built that model, and then we modeled it out, as you see in these last two slides, to look at a mixed SAN workload, an Exchange 2010 DAS workload and an Oracle 11G DAS workload across a wide range of capacities and users. And essentially the user count went from like less than 100 all the way up to 60,000. And you can see the terabytes from 4 terabytes to 1,200 terabytes. So this one chart that shows using ROA to compare DAS and SAN costs shows the cost per terabyte per month on the vertical axis and then the different scenarios on the horizontal axis. And what we did is we assumed that SANs of 20 terabytes and under used an iSCSI SAN. The larger SANs, we modeled an EMC CX for the 100 and 200 terabytes, and we used a VMAX for 500 and 1200 terabytes. It includes everything. It's an IT budget view, so it includes the server and software license costs to accommodate increased compute requirements, because if you're not doing it in the array, you got to do it, you know, in the host, and all assumptions around DAS and SAN utilization. And if you want to dig into this, you can see the links at the bottom. We've got all these assumptions laid out. What we found is the following. In no instance is Oracle less expensive than SAN, and that's really DAS versus SAN, and that's due to Oracle's license fees, at pretty substantial license fees per server, tens of thousands of dollars per server. So there really was no crossover point. Whereas in the case of Exchange 2010, that crossover point was around 750 seats. And so we modeled this out and found that under 1,000 seats, it actually, from a cost perspective, made sense to go with DAS, and then over that, at scale, you started to see that crossover. And the reason was that two reasons. One is really the main reason. SAN is a fungible asset that can be shared across the application portfolio. And then the second is an assumption that we made in there that as you scaled beyond 20 to 100 terabytes and up, you were sharing that infrastructure across 3, 4, and multiple applications in the portfolio. And as a result, utilization went up of the assets and costs went down. And you can see in the last chart, which is the storage cost detail at 200 terabyte installation, is the drill down at 200 terabytes. So this is, again, a high-level view, but it's the hardware and software depreciation. So we depreciated the CapEx, took a 4-year storage TCO, maintenance, environmental, staffing, and then other related costs. And you can see that the shared model still has an advantage. Now, when we shared this with some of the practitioners, we got back, yeah, okay, we get that. But again, there's other reasons not to go with that SAN complexity. And they ranged from just that complexity, we didn't have the skill sets, to oftentimes political. We don't want to go to another group to get the SAN, our storage. We want to do it within our application, within our exchange group. So there was some very interesting dynamics going on. But we're just presenting from a cost standpoint, this is what the data shows, that the one-off model is more expensive, probably around 15% at 200 terabytes. And then as you scale, efficiency improves, anywhere from 8 to 23% was what the data showed. And that key enabler there was the ability to share resources across applications. So let me stop there. David Fuller, do you have anything to add? Because this is really your modeling.
No, I think you've done a fantastic summary of it in a shorter time scale than I would have done.
Great. So let's open it up. Any thoughts on that? Any comments? You want to debate that? Does this make sense to people?
Yeah, Dave, it's Rob Pegler. Just a very quick comment. I think the model is very good, so hats off to you guys at Wikibon for putting that together. And in general, it certainly makes sense. The political points are also well taken. But I would bring up two additional factors here. And it's absolutely true. I mean, the rationale behind SAN to begin with was the ability to share the asset, to use it amongst multiple application and OS and hypervisor stacks. Now, truth be told, in practice, many practitioners actually still segregate their arrays between OSs or application stacks, so you lose the benefit of actually sharing, and what you get is a big silo or multiple silos in a big frame. But the idea that actually direct attach of storage is not fungible, again, is not true if you use the element-based approach. The elements are fungible. They can be shared if you like, or not, as you choose. So you don't get this either-or as it's compared with just rotating a disk inside server enclosures. So that's one. The other thing is certainly while SAN is fungible and shareable and it has a wonderful history behind it, if you do share SAN assets across applications and OSs and hypervisors, you often get reduced performance, which again is one of the rationales why the application guys are moving away from SAN, not necessarily because they don't like to share data or be capacity efficient, but they see performance degradation when the arrays are shared, and that's one of the downfalls of traditional SAN architecture. And again, the element-based approach takes you out of that completely, so you don't see performance degradation, especially as you fill up an array. So those are two points to consider as well.
Thank you. This is David Floyd. Just to add to that commentary, obviously one of the areas where arrays can help is with large-scale striping. It's usually much easier to do that within an array environment as opposed to a DAS environment. But again, to Rob's point, you can also do that in element-based. So pure DAS often is more difficult to do the very high-performance stuff.
Hey, Dave?
Yes.
Dave, hi. This is Bob Jefferson. How are you?
Hey, Bob. Good to talk to you.
Nice to hear your voice. This is a great study. As I sit here and I realize that the discussion goes far beyond, just simply DAS versus SAN, I thought I heard you say that as you were recapping the two slides here, the two charts, that under 1,000 seats, it had the appearance that the DAS approach was more flexible, more efficient. Did I hear that correct?
Yeah, so the crossover point that we found in our research, and this specifically talks to Exchange 2010, and by the way, at the bottom of that link, you'll see probably, I don't know, five or six or seven other links that drill down into a lot of the detail behind these studies, so I would encourage people to look at those. And by the way, it started with the old tongue-in-cheek, the classic Dave Vellante blog on why Microsoft's head is up its DAS, and so that got this whole discussion going, and we actually brought in Google Apps into the discussion as well. So we went, pretty much back to the beginning. So, but when you look at that data, what we found was at about 750 seats for an Exchange 2010 environment and under, that DAS was actually less expensive because you had that increased complexity of SAN, and you weren't able to share that asset across the application portfolio, And as you scaled beyond that, we made specific assumptions around utilization, which are all laid out in those documents, and that in particular drove the cost of a shared infrastructure down. So yes, 750 was that crossover point. And again, this is just a pure TCO, right? We didn't look at availability, we didn't look at other factors of business value. It was just a pure cost, and it was using that ROA methodology. So one of the reasons why we did this is we wanted to test the assertion that DAS is cheaper than SAN. And the answer was, it depends. And the other point was, oftentimes at scale, it's not. And so that's the other interesting discussion here that I'd at some point be interested in having, is that element-based approach or other DAS approaches that we're seeing, how far do they scale, how much can they scale, and how much can we expect from them. But go ahead, Bob. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. And I see the links to the research here, so I'll take a look through that as well. Thanks.
You're welcome. Any other thoughts or comments?
Yeah, this is John MacArthur. Just curious, Dave Floyer, from your model, if you look at how some of the application vendors are integrating with the storage services of the infrastructure providers like NetApp, EMC, 3PAR, whomever, because it seems like from a management perspective, it's easier sometimes for an app administrator to manage certain things, but to have the infrastructure layer deliver those services. Can you speak to that at all?
Sure. I didn't include that in the model, but you're absolutely right. There is quite a lot of activity going on in the application stacks to link to specific capabilities that are available in the infrastructure. Snap copies, for example, because they are in general much more efficient at that level than having to do it yourself. So there's both trends, both pulling it up into the stack itself and also linking to specific capabilities in the infrastructure. But both of those trends are going on, particularly in VMware.
Dave, I'm also thinking from the perspective of application consistency, ensuring that the application is recoverable from a snapshot and things like that. I mean, who better knows the status of the application than the application itself?
Right.
So how does that
that's really true for database. And that's almost always where, you know, 99% of the consistency requirements are, is within the database itself. So it definitely, if there are very high levels of availability, as John Blackman was talking about, continuous data protection, if you really need very, very low levels of RPO, then clearly that's a better way to go. If your level is not quite as sophisticated as that, and that you are comfortable with taking a periodic snaps, for example, and putting those remotely, that's a significantly cheaper way of providing a slightly lower level of RPO, very significantly lower. And doing that via services would offer a very comfortable and cheaper solution for applications. So for Oracle, for example, they are both investing in ASM, offloading of ASM function to the array, as well as the more sophisticated data guard and other capabilities to provide a richer service or capability. So both those trends are going on. Does that make sense, John?
Yeah, thanks.
What about Exchange, particularly Exchange 2010 with its IP-based replication? And would you agree there that it's easier to and more reliable and resilient to provide recovery in the application stack?
Or in that particular example, yes, clearly. The complexity of providing the levels of consistency that you would need via an IP stack, it doesn't cut it at the moment. So if you need the highest levels of recoverability, I mean, if you're a Charles Schwab, for example, and you need to be 100% sure that every email is captured, then the Microsoft IP in 2010 isn't yet sufficiently robust to achieve that. I'm sure they'll put resources into that and make it better over time, but there are very, very clear business reasons why in recovery, for most applications at the moment, why you would continue to invest in array-based solutions. The only exceptions, I think, are in the database areas, Oracle.
I just want to get some clarity there. Go ahead. Was there another? Just let me summarize. So I want to make sure I understood what you said. So the answer to John's question was yes. It makes sense, particularly in database. However, you're saying in Exchange 2010, it doesn't because of IP-based replication. Okay, so I understand that. But the database, yes. Exchange 2010, not so much. Other applications, you know, up for discussion, I guess. Another comment? Somebody else had a comment?
Well, a question here, Dave.
Go ahead.
Ben Berman.
Hi, Dave.
Does Model look at all about storage tiering? I know a huge amount of the industry is looking at storage tiering. I've heard a lot of references to concern about sharing a SAN array because of performance impact of competing workloads. But if I can identify, but so from both a performance and a cost perspective, if I can tier down that data that's fairly static and tier up to flash that data that's really critical, I can probably reduce my ROI even more or improve my ROI even more while improving performance.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because it was something that I meant to ask when Rob was speaking. I mean, the whole impact of flash, that's the movement of function back to the host is clearly supported by persistent flash, and oftentimes at the other side of the channel. So you're seeing architectures like Fusion IO and others that can place function in a persistent data cache or a persistent flash. And that sort of begins to change the notion of tiering from one of, you know, sort of this weird tiering that we had before flash to now one of, you know, tier zero and then the bit bucket, which is what a lot of users are thinking about doing. But does anybody have any comments on that, on tiering? Is it in the context of this discussion?
Well, this is John Blackman. So what you just raised is kind of an interesting question regarding not so much the different performance grades or the different tiers, and I like to call them more performance grades than actual tiers. But what you're actually describing is a very proactive monitoring of application performance, almost down to the, you know, second level. In other words, if you're monitoring an application or the applications across your enterprise, so that each one of those applications may migrate between performance tiers at any given moment, just because of how what's necessary or what data is static and what data is being accessed. I believe what you're going to create is a little bit more cost to do the management of storage than the actual benefit that you're going to receive from it. Now, I would agree, I would say that there are tools out there that claim, and probably arrays that claim, that they will do it all behind the scenes for you at no cost, but there is an issue there, and that is you may have already charged a certain project a certain amount of money for the type of storage that they are going to be on, and now you have to manage capacity at a much more granular level to ensure that those applications all have the correct level of performance. Or you have to define applications that you're not going to manage and applications that you're going to manage. And again, you're going to probably create more work for your organization than putting them on a certain performance grade and only at thresholds where you're going to manually intervene. And what I mean manually intervene, it's going to be, was this a momentary blip on my screen, or is this a sustained activity where we know that this application needs better performance? I would also say that if you've sold to an application that they're on a performance grade 3 type storage, and all of a sudden they decide that they have misplanned their own capacity and they really need like a performance grade 2 or 1 type storage, that you're going to have to find a mechanism to go back to that application or that project and actually charge for an additional service that they may not even have funding for, and it's just going to be something you're going to have to do. And therefore, your cost-benefit analysis that you're going to provide your CIO becomes skewed.
Yeah, so you're saying maybe build some of that fluff factor into your overall planning.
I think it takes a lot of work then, right?
Yeah.
I think you've raised two different good points. I mean, one is the cross-charge in a tiered model, and the other one is how much manual effort it is to maintain and implement the tiering. And clearly, I think that there's a big trend among the technologists, among the storage array technologies, to automate that function in such a way that you're not thrashing, that you're not moving things back and forth on a, you know, second-by-second basis, but, you know, averaging it over a period of time or identifying, you know, your batch processing at night versus your normal day-to-day processing or your month close or your, you know, your quarter close, that you could take advantage of that with tiering. But your cross-charge issue is a valid issue and one that I think is going to be a challenge.
Well, and if you, let's just say, bring it up a level where you're doing storage virtualization outside disk arrays and maybe across multiple disk arrays, now you've removed a lot of the functionality of those intelligent disk arrays and you place it upon the virtualization engine to understand what is trying to be done. And they may not have the horsepower necessary to understand when to migrate data and when not to.
So I think that the conclusion here, just so we don't go too far afield, is that the notion of performance grades as it relates specifically to what people are calling storage tiering, things that you're seeing from like EMC with FAST and 3PAR and Compellent, perhaps affects the way in which you charge back that cross-charge notion that, that John and David were talking about. And at the end of the day, it's something that you've got to build into your decision around whether you go application stacks or array-based services approaches. Other comments? We got just a few more minutes, about three or four more minutes. Anybody who hasn't spoken want to speak?
David?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, this is Mike Alvarado.
Oh, hi, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, I've been listening carefully, and it seems to me that there are two views that have been presented. One, and I think the data is a really good foundation, but the first view is really around kind of an infrastructure cost comparison. The second view, which is compared to that, is about application availability. But it's interesting because right at the top of the hour, you were talking about how sort of the Google approach is really winning a lot of converts at the executive decision level. So I think if this discussion was framed in terms of its potential value propositions or delivery of value, then I think there's a, another lens or another framework that we could be looking at this argument, and that's about what infrastructure would enable the greatest addition to the value of the information that corporations have, or what can we do to improve the information value. And I think this is another, this is a reason why you can argue that application-based function actually has a unique and different value compared to putting it into devices or infrastructure, because one of the few places that a lot of the important context around information, how it's used, who's using it, why it's used, the only place you find that is up in the application. That doesn't mean it's the only place you would ever find it, but I think if you look at where you can add or where you can associate those things which become value for information, about information, and therefore value for the corporations, then I think that's a reason why you should relook at this application. But I think, as I say, I have these three sort of lenses that I've been drawing out, and I'll send you something to clarify my thinking. But I think this discussion suggests there's a different way to look at this, and I think that's, you know, that's based on where the greatest value to corporations is going to come from, and it's based on leveraging their information.
That's an excellent point. And by the way, Mike, if you want to put that up on Wikibon, feel free to do that. Just on the help link, there's a little discussion as to how to put up a professional alert, and so feel free to do that. You'll get, you know, obviously your name will be attached to it automatically. But I think the point you're making is that, and back up with just a one bit, we saw, you know, the last few years, a lot of organizations just doing mix, match, and manage. The application guys were just pretty much doing what they needed, and the infrastructure guys were providing it as directed. And we are seeing the Google effect say, wait a minute, guys, we need to be more sane about that. If we, in fact, are going to spend more, we need to justify it. And as John pointed out, I don't know if the number is 10, 20, 30%, but some proportion should be application-based. I think what we're proposing is that in those instances where you are going to spend more, make sure it's justified. And your point, Mike, is there's other ways to justify it, including the value of information, you know, beyond just recovery, performance, security, cost, et cetera. It's the value of information, how it's used, and who's using it. All right, we've got time for one more comment, then we've got to wrap. Okay, great. So on behalf of the Wikibon community, I want to thank Omer Pera and David Foyer for supporting the call today, and also the other Wikibon members who contributed and joined in, John Blackman. Thank you for lending us your cube, and Rob Pegler, your perspectives on architecture and the element model, which is this new emerging model that we hope to learn more about. Bob Jefferson, great to hear from you again as well. John MacArthur, thanks for coming in. David Berman, good to talk to you, and as well, Mike Alvarado. As a reminder, our next Peer Insight meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, April 6th, and our old friend Eugene Hakopians from Caltech will be joining us again, speaking on the topic of data center efficiency, how Caltech uses standard building blocks to streamline cost and energy consumption. And as another reminder, over the next 24 hours, we'll have up on Wikibon 6 research notes pertaining to this call today with user actions. So look for those, and please feel free to hit the edit tab to improve the pieces, or put up your own piece, or even write a wiki tip. And we'll be producing a podcast of this call as well that we'll be sending out. So thanks for listening today, everybody. And thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.